Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. I am Bicom CEO James Serene. I'm delighted to have with me as our first guest this week, Kobi Huberman, who is the founder and director of the Israeli Regional Initiative, someone who has spent many years talking to officials and important people in many Gulf states and Arab countries, and has a very clear insight and understanding of what is going on in a lot of key states in the Gulf and the wider Arab world vis-a-vis relations with Israel and how sort of interests are converging. Welcome, Kobi, to the Bicom podcast.
Thank you.
I just wanted to start off by really just getting your sense of the Bahrain conference next week. What do you think that conference is going to do to change the dynamic between Israel and some of these states? Or do you think it could potentially harm it? What's your thought?
The view that I have regarding the Bahrain conference is not in the sphere of relationship, the emerging relationship between Israel and the Gulf states, but within the context of trying to reach an Israeli-Palestinian agreement in the context of a much regional, wider regional framework. So I look at Bahrain not as something that is serving Israel-Gulf relations, but in something that should serve the logic of involving Arab states in the Israeli-Palestinian file and trying to build, rather than an old guard bilateral model, a trilateral model within the Israeli-Palestinian regional framework. From that perspective, Bahrain conference is just the first step. I'm not sure it is the right one, but it is not going to be something to be viewed as, you know, a catalyst to Israeli Gulf state relationship, which have been evolving quite dramatically over the past decade.
Could you tell us a bit about how they've evolved dramatically and where you think we are now? Because I think that would be quite interesting.
I think everybody remembers Prime Minister Netanyahu's visit to Oman and clear statements from Netanyahu ever since August 2014, quite dramatically highlighting the emerging opportunity of converging interests between Israel and some of the Sunni Arab states vis-a-vis shared threats. The shared threats in the region are Iran and its proxies, it's ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. And this is compounded also with economic challenges and the regime stability challenges that those countries might face. Israel and these countries, and in particular, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates, they share the same vision and the same set of interests working together towards stabilizing the region and fighting those threats. These have emerged, I believe, around 10 years ago and became even more clear around the JCPOA agreement in 2015, around other regional challenges, you know, facing Iran and Al-Qaeda. And by now, it is no secret that Israel and some of these states are working quietly behind the scene, beneath the table, to build and foster cooperation in various fields, of course, in the realm of security and fighting the shared threats, but also, I believe, commercially and diplomatically. Most of it is, of course, behind the scene, and it doesn't reach its full potential because the glass ceiling, in front of all these potential cooperation agreements is, of course, the progress and potentially the resolution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has remained at the heart of the issues and the stumbling block towards major normalization. And, you know, while there has been some progress, nobody should doubt the seniority and the centrality of the Palestinian issues among these regional frameworks.
So you're definitely of the view that, you know, all this stuff is very good. There are things that we will hear about, like, you know, overflights for aircraft over Saudi Arabia or maybe a bit of trade here and there. But what you're saying is you're not going to get full normalization. You're not going to get full diplomatic relations until basically either there's a Palestinian state on the sort of lines of the Arab Peace Initiative in some way, or at least very, very concrete progress towards that. That's your view.
Well, I think there has been some dramatic shift from the original premise of the Arab Peace Initiative, which, you know, dictated a clear agreement first between Israel and Palestinians, and only then potential normalization. I think that what we have seen in the past 10 years is a gradual shift from that historic position towards, you know, a willingness to consider certain steps and work on certain areas of cooperation if and when there is progress towards the two-state solution, not necessarily when it has been achieved. Yeah. The reason is that the Arab states know all too well that it is not feasible to reach the two-state solution in one dramatic move, and there's got to be some graduality in the process of reaching it. But what is probably going to be more acceptable is to agree on a clear horizon, without the details, but at least a horizon that they could feel comfortable during the time between now and achieving it, to make gestures and to move forward, provided that steps towards that Israel is taking, positive steps that Israel takes towards the Palestinians, are going to be rewarded by quiet, progressive steps coming from the Arab states. So we're looking at a different dancing, different choreography that was not possible in the past. And the mere fact that it is now conceivable and in some cases even acted upon is a major progress.
The interesting framing of this Bahrain conference is that it's really trying to talk about economic issues. And I want to just move sideways and just ask a question, which I've heard you talk about before, is that there seems to be a bit of an impatience, almost like an urgency and a real desire by people, business leaders, others in some of the Gulf states and other states to really actually develop closer ties with Israel, because they understand that they want and need Israeli technology. There's other things about Israel and the Israeli economy that they want to have access to and want to develop greater links with, because they want it for their own countries. I just wondered if you could just say a bit about that impatience and that real desire to develop these ties, because I think that's quite important.
Yeah, and thank you for the question, because I'd like to clarify two fundamental points. No business person that I know of in the entire region is willing to look at building economic ties with Israel without linking it to diplomatic progress vis-a-vis the Palestinians. So, you know, the full potential of business relationship is never going to be achieved, even with all the desire and all the passion to do business, without seeing progress, clear progress on the Israeli-Palestinian front. Point number two, the passion is no longer just to position Israel as the provider of high tech and the Arab states as the recipients of the great Israeli technology. Not at all. I think that was a mistake that was that is not going to be repeated, I hope, but that was a mistake at the heart of some of the ideas of the new Middle East concepts back in the early 90s of the previous century. We need to change the perspective, and rather than seeing Israel as the provider and the Arab states as the recipients, we need to think completely differently, and we need to think as equal partners in resurrecting and building a prosperous region. And it is not going to be done just by, you know, unilateral trade. It's got to be done through cooperation. And the cooperation means that the development of resources in the Middle East, and I can take a number of growth engines just to document and manifest that, you cannot do it just with Israeli technology. Thinking about the benefits of trade and movement and transportation and energy optimization, it is not just something that Israel provides. It is something that we should be doing together. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the discourse is no longer the new Middle East where Israel could, you know, save the region. Not at all. Mm-hmm. I personally object to that. I think it is completely out of line. It undermines the fundamentals of true cooperation. And instead, I believe, and I've seen this, and I've been working with many other partners around the region on building a shared responsibility and cooperation model. And then we see what aspects in each country could be leveraged in order to bring the region in total to a significant improvement thanks to diplomatic progress.
The way that we look at this, it's hard to really decipher exactly what's going on, but trying to really sort of analyze it in a simple way is that it looks like a plan to try and leverage support from across the other, from the Arab world, to maybe put together some initiatives and maybe a pot of money that can be used to invest in the Palestinian economy. I just wondered what you thought of that model and whether if you were in charge, you would have that conference right now without any political context, because you've talked about the importance of the sort of political progress, and the Americans have made a decision that this is just about what they call the economic component. So that's quite an interesting thing for them to do. I just wondered if you could answer that.
Again, I have to share with you the fact that, yes, I am for a comprehensive approach that ties several parties together and ties diplomacy, security, economic development, and, if you like, normalization. So I am for a comprehensive approach. You know, trying to eliminate the comprehensive framework and take just one element and highlight it is against the nature of what I believe in. Yeah. Having said that, I could understand why the American team chose and decided the way they chose to move on. Not that I justify this, but I can understand why for them it made sense at this particular point because of other considerations and constraints, if I can say. They could not wait any longer. I think they got a real blow from the political debacle in Israel that extended the point until there is a government and political clarity, and therefore it caught them by surprise. And I think that from their perspective, launching just the economic element would make sense just to show progress. I think it will be badly received by the region because people would like to see the political element. But I would like to add just one word of warning. I think it is very difficult to judge something that has not been presented. Sure. I'm familiar with all the leaks about the presumable American plan, and I can tell you that I've already figured out three variations of an American plan over the past 2 years, and I don't know what it will end up looking like. So I think we all need today to take a bit of a caution, a bit of a patience, and understand this is an unfolding process. I believe eventually a clear political horizon that builds the future based on the two-state solution in the spirit of the Arab Peace Initiative, tied with economic development, security cooperation, and steps towards normalization. That is the formula. But the Americans have not yet put all their cards on the table. I have my concerns, I have my guesswork, but we all need a little bit more of patience and maybe some humbleness about what it looks like.
Yeah. I don't want to push you too hard to predict, but I just wanted to get your sense of like, if this week we see at the conference that there is some kind of commitment to put money into this. I mean, firstly, do you think there might be a commitment to actually come up with numbers from some of the Arab states, or do you think it's going to be very general?
Okay. I believe that what will be revealed in Bahrain is far less detailed than what has already been discussed.
Right.
Second, I believe that what has been discussed has been pretty well handcuffed with preconditions. I don't think that any of the Arab states would be willing to pour money into unclear diplomatic situations. So I think they put strings attached to every commitment, had it been general or specific. Third, I believe that the real challenge of Bahrain is the spirit that comes out of it. Whether there is a backwind, some sort of support for the Americans to move forward, or cold feet. And I think that the music that comes out of Bahrain and the tone and the attitude, I by far or at least as important as the content. And I think it will be an opportunity for the Americans to learn two things. First of all, what is really the maximum they can expect without presenting a political horizon? And second, what would be required of them if they were to unleash the economic plan into implementation? What will be required on the political side? Because the overhanging cloud over Bahrain from a regional perspective, and I would say more Palestinian than regional, is the whole idea that you cannot put the 100 or plus years of conflict, of conflicting narratives, of a sense of victimhood, justified or not justified by the Palestinians. You cannot put that to rest through a transactional approach. You don't buy people's dreams, you don't buy people's pain, you don't buy people's aspirations and trading them with standard of living.
Yeah.
And I think this administration made significant progress since its start by understanding that the solution cannot be just Israeli-Palestinian, the Arab states must be involved. And therefore, from our perspective as the IRR group, this is a major step forward, understanding of the importance of involving the regional element. Second, definitely said it's got to be done by adding a major economic component, but it's got to be done with very strong ties to a political horizon at the heart of which we see two states, regional cooperation on economics, regional security, and regional normalization in the spirit of the Arab Peace Initiative. And therefore, yes, the American administration is making the steps in the right directions. Is it going the full mile that's needed? I don't know yet. I have my doubts, but we are in a process of unfolding new attitude and new paradigm, and we'll have to wait to see where the next step is. May I add a word of caution? I am concerned not by what will happen in Bahrain, but what signals will come out of Bahrain to people in the West Bank and in Gaza and in Jordan, and to what extent it will cause or become a trigger of despair that would lead to violence.
There's already a plan for strikes, and there's also a plan for the Palestinian Authority to get European Union and other states to sort of sign up to a commitment that, you know, you have to have the basic contours, you know, Palestinian state, East Jerusalem is the capital, to kind of commit to that. So they're definitely doing the noise off stage to really up the ante in that level.
Correct. Yet, I think that what we have seen in the past, in the last two intifadas, and the eruption of violence is not always rationally planned and anticipated. Mm-hmm. It could be an event in the outskirts of a Palestinian town or something on the road that ignites the violence beneath the surface. The question that I have is not just about Bahrain, but what will happen between Bahrain, Ramallah, and Gaza?
Yeah.
This is what matters more to me than anything else. Yeah. And the fact that the Palestinians are not going to be there is in a way building an insurance policy to create some legitimacy for them to be violent or to be angry about whatever comes out of Bahrain.
Just on a very quick final point, I mean, we've talked about, you know, what the Palestinian narrative is going to be about the conference. But on the Israeli side, it's fascinating. I mean, you've got Israeli journalists saying that, you know, that they're going to be covering the event. You're going to have an interesting Israeli delegation, which includes a former Israeli army general who ran the COGAT that runs sort of Israel's relations with the West Bank and Gaza, and somebody, Poli Mordechai is his name, who came up with some very creative ideas for Gaza and who's got, you know, a lot of experience in this. And he's going to be there alongside some very interesting figures from the Arab world. So, I mean, do you think that kind of what they call optics is going to be interesting for Israelis to watch, and it will make them feel a little bit like, you know, things are really changing in terms of Israel's relations with the Arab world?
You know, I think I can naturally share with you the journey that the Israeli public has gone through over the past decade, from complete ignorance about the regional benefits to much more understanding as we see now. You know, when we first came with the regional idea for the two states and the comprehensive solution back in 2007, there were very few people that we could talk to. Now it has become some sort of the mainstream thinking around Israel that peace with the Palestinians will be achieved only if it is within a framework with the Arab world. And indeed, in the past 5-6 years, this has been substantially supported by Israeli leaders from right, center, and left, who said, yes, we have an opportunity to strengthen relationship with the Arab world, and that would lead to peace, eventually. So I think that for Israelis, this is yet another proof point that the glass ceiling in the region could be broken, and that this could bring tremendous benefits to Israel and tremendous benefits to the regions. But people also realize that it's got to be linked to some progress vis-a-vis the Palestinians, and more people understand that linkage. Now, specifically, the individuals that are going to participate, I welcome the choice that the Americans have made, because I think those individuals could either help, thanks to their persona, experience, abilities, connections inside Israel, or thanks to their specific areas of expertise. So even if it is not officials, these are very, very important ambassadors that, when coming back home to Israel, would definitely bring a different spirit to the Israeli public. And that in and of itself is going to be a major advantage.
Okay, I think we will leave it there. But thank you so much for giving us such a thorough overview and sharing us with your expertise. And if our listeners are not already know about Kobi's work at the Israel Regional Initiative, then do check it out and all the very interesting papers that are on their website. Thank you very much for joining us, Kobi.
Thank you, James. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, everyone. This is Roni from BICOM, and I'm delighted to have with me today David Makovsky on the latest edition of BICOM's podcast. David is the Ziegler Distinguished Fellow and the Director of the Project on Arab-Israel Relations at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. David also worked in the office of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry between 2013 and 2014, serving as a senior advisor to the Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations. So, David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Delighted to be with you, Roni.
Great. And I'm especially thrilled to have such a seasoned peace process veteran as yourself on today's podcast, because it is coinciding with the publication of BICOM's most recent briefing examining the history of the U.S. role in peacemaking. So if we just jump right into this, as someone who worked in the Kerry negotiations and has been intimately involved with the issue for the last couple decades, closely following it, how would you describe the traditional American approach to the peace process and to the core issues of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
I would say the following. Look, the blueprint was kind of done at Oslo itself, which has now been over 25 years ago. And in 1993, there was this historic breakthrough of two national movements who had really not talked to each other in a century and were vying for the same narrow area of land. I think the Zionists tried, certainly at the partition plan in 47. There had been some other attempts. But this was the big breakthrough of two national movements saying, okay, we got to deal with each other. We have to compromise. We have to share the land. But they found that there were four issues that were the toughest nuts to crack, so to speak. And that was the issue of the borders. That was the issue of the security arrangements surrounding those borders, the issue of Jerusalem, and the issue of refugees. Later on, a fifth issue emerged called mutual recognition. Do you accept the character of the other side state? Issues that used to be considered very tough, like water, have been made easier because of technology, desalination plants. It's not zero sum. But those four issues, which became five, essentially were seen as, if we try to do it all, if it's all or nothing in the Middle East, it's nothing. Incrementalism was born really in with that Oslo agreement. Got to get something started. Set up a Palestinian authority in the West Bank and Gaza. And so basically, U.S. diplomacy kind of derived from that. And that is the belief that, okay, now how are we going to solve these final core issues? The three efforts the U.S. extended, which was Clinton 2000 at Camp David, and the follow-on, the Clinton parameters, the last few months of his presidency, Condoleezza Rice's efforts, 2007 and 8, it was called the Annapolis process, when she was also shuttling between Abbas and Olmert. And then the effort I was a part of with Kerry, 2013-14. Those are three major efforts by the United States, led by the Secretary of State in two of these instances, by the president in the first instance. But so for those three efforts, how do you solve those final issues? So that's kind of been the driving focus. Now you have President Trump comes in and says, I don't want to play small ball. I want to solve all of those issues, but I'm sure we'll talk about it. But he wants to put an economic twist to them as well. So, and that was always going to be part of any final status deal, was an economic component. So how you bring that all together is now something that is being discussed.
Now, you mentioned specifically the Trump administration and his approach to the peace process. And one of the things that we look at in this paper is that even though his plan is a closed secret, what we've seen from his comments and from the comments of people around him have suggested a different approach to what you have described being the traditional approach in the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. So could you speak perhaps a little bit on how the Trump approach has been different to what his predecessors have done?
Right. I think, look, it's fair to say that if traditionally the predecessors focused on the political horizon and that was mostly gained for the Palestinians, the Trump approach in theory is more of a win-win situation that also talks about an economic horizon, a vision for what peace would look like in terms of economic development. Does that mean infrastructure projects, I don't know, roads, railroads, ports, things like that for Israel, the Palestinian Authority, and for Jordan, maybe a little Egypt and Lebanon even, but to show how what people have to gain, not just about land. And so I think as part of a package, it has appeal. The problem has been is that the political part, these core final, what we call final status issues that I just mentioned before, are ones the Palestinians and some of the Arabs believe will fall short. You could call it Clinton minus or Clinton minus minus in terms of those metrics that they look at on those other issues, on those five issues. And even if there's economics plus plus, I think the way I analyzed Bahrain is this conference was to kind of spin it off almost independently of it, and not call it that, call it a precursor, of course, but to say, okay, maybe our ideas are a little controversial, even though we're not sharing them. So let's at least focus on economics because we can all agree that people want a better quality of life. Unfortunately, that is being characterize on the Palestinian Authority side, who are mad at the Palestinians, at the U.S. for believing on the five core issues they're going to come short of the mark, as, oh, they want to buy us. We call it economic peace. You think you could buy our political aspirations by quality of life issues. And that's clearly no one believes that's possible. So, you know, I see Bahrain as a kind of a tacit admission by the administration that a grand package is not imminent. And so let's lead with our best foot forward and let's focus on economics. And the key for them is to have it not mischaracterized. But then the catch 22 is, it's like you want the Saudis and the Emiratis to pay for all this. Maybe this is $62 billion over several years, but what are we paying for if we don't know the political side, you know, those five final status issues? So it's like, do you get the economic gold if you don't go for the political gold? That's kind of the catch 22 they're in. They don't feel that the political gold is ready. And at the same time, people aren't going to give money for half a plan. And so will Kushner's efforts in articulating the vision show how do you get there? I don't think he's going to get into the political thing. He says he wasn't, he would not. And then are they going to do more short-term stabilization measures of infrastructure in Gaza, like water, desal, electricity, that are really needed now? But that goes against Trump's thesis, which is different than his predecessor's. His thesis is maximum pressure works. So I don't want to give anything short-term unless I know I've got buy-in for the grand deal.
Right. So specifically on this summit, you mention again that it's just the economic, and the White House has said that they wanted to just focus on the economic aspect and not the political one. So how do you kind of square the circle in that sense between what Trump wants, what might actually be possible coming out of this, and what do you think the administration might see as being a success?
It's a great question of how do you define success, or how do they define success? It's unclear. It should be noted that this is probably the third meeting in a row where you had a meeting in Gaza at the White House in March of 2018. You had a meeting in Warsaw in January 2019. Now this meeting next week, where Arab states are sending people to a conference despite an explicit Palestinian boycott. This was unthinkable in the past. While the Palestinians were kind of, you know, they were the gatekeepers on this issue. In a certain way, they aren't. Now, there are enough gatekeepers that I don't think that the U.S. could put forward a final status idea that the Arabs will endorse over the Palestinians' objections. So I don't want to get carried away. But the fact that there's even a meeting is interesting, because clearly the PA is calling for a boycott, and yet the Arabs are not boycotting. Now, you know, the pundits will look at the level of representation. Are the Jordanians sending their equivalent to Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury or Finance, you know, and so people will look at the level of who's there. It could be, you know, for Kushner, who has personally worked on the economic dimension of the peace plan, you know, just laying out the vision is something that is good enough, because he could say, here, I have just painted a portrait for you of an economic horizon, and that should motivate everybody. But the question again is, how do you get to A to B? And I'm sure they will say, we will unveil the political part at the right time, but there doesn't seem to be a right time, also given unprecedented political turmoil in Israel, two elections back to back, and then you're getting into the American political cycle. What I'm beginning to wonder more and more is, will the idea of an economic vision be matched with a political vision, but not an economic plan or a political plan? That'll be more like a painting on a wall that you could look at it and say, hey, this is a reference point for future peacemaking, as opposed to saying, we want you to negotiate on this basis tomorrow morning. I feel that is receding. To me, a success, and I don't know if the administration would define it the same way, is, look, in 95% of the water in Gaza is not drinkable now. Let's do something practical and try to focus on infrastructure. Maybe we even call for a timeout between the parties for a ceasefire, and we could focus on economic development. Now, this is not easy because of the split in Gaza between the PA and Hamas, but I think if the PA doesn't come back, will countries invest in Gaza with Hamas leadership? I don't know. So I would define success as not just can you articulate a vision, but can you put forward a substantial plan that you could operationalize that would prove people's lives and would demonstrate that the rhetoric is not abstract, but it is real. And that, I think, is, to me, how I think I will look at this conference. How the administration will might be different. They might be satisfied with a vision, but I think a vision is nice, but it's insufficient, and you need practical ideas to improve things on the ground.
So perhaps one last question for you. And in early February, we were delighted to host you in London. And one of the things that you spoke about during this conversation was the lack of a zone of possible agreement between Israelis and Palestinians, which is something that you've spoken about experiencing firsthand during the Kerry negotiations. So, and the other thing that you speak about is that failure is not neutral. So how do you sort of square that circle? I mean, do you think that Trump's push for this peace deal is doomed to fail? Do you think that there needs to be some sort of plan B to ensure that this failure does not cause maybe any more damage if it gets to that point? How do you sort of see this?
No, I think you put forward, good questions, and I've been a believer more in plan B, which is that, I won't use the American metaphor for a British audience of trying to hit a home run ball. I will say, instead of trying to run the marathon, run the 5K race. Do something that's tangible that will get people to believe again on both sides. Right now, they think a lot of this is words, and they're skeptical and sometimes even downright cynical. So to me, it's important that the leaders take some hard positions that would, get people to believe there's a partner on the other side. I know that does not sound as inspirational as solving the conflict, but we've tried, the Palestinian critique has been, incrementalism can only go so far. But when I fear the opposite approach is whenever it's all or nothing in the Mideast, it's nothing. And we've tried three times to solve it all and it hasn't worked. I think the administration itself, when it came in, I think its views have evolved since they came in. I think when they came in, they really hoped, look, the Arab states in Israel, their strategic convergence on Iran, they want to limit Iran's and thwart Iran's regional ambitions. Therefore, they will twist Palestinian arms. I think they know now that there are limits here. I mean, the relationship between one of the biggest funders, the Emirates, and the PA is like non-existent. And the Saudi relationship is also not good. So I don't think the outside in is what they came in with, I think, is not where it is today. I think their expectations are lower. But I would like to see something incremental that would be like a timeout, a ceasefire, where the focus would be on economics and kind of bringing things back. Because when there's economic desperation, I think people feel they don't have much to lose, and the chance of a security blow up in Gaza, maybe even this summer, is not unthinkable. So I think something more modest that people would say, okay, we could actually do this. This is doable. This doesn't cross ideological lines. And the irony is, someone like King Jordan King Abdullah of Jordan, you're not asking him to cross lines by saying, hey, I'm going to give this more of Jerusalem to the Israelis. That's a huge headache for him. So, I mean, I think if you don't try to overdo it and try to solve all the problems that risk crossing these lines and therefore have the chance of violence, you have a better shot of getting people to join you. That means having the Jordanians try to get the PA back into Gaza and focusing on economic issues. Maybe even having a technocratic government there that, that accepts the quartet principles. But to me, I would rather try to achieve less, but have more results. And I worry, as you said in your question, that if you keep trying and failing, you just deepen the despair of people that anything is possible. So I think we need to avoid the straitjacket of all or nothing. We shouldn't try to win the marathon, but I think we should try to at least run the 5K race.
Great. Well, thank you so much, David, for your insight on this timely topic. And really grateful to have you on our podcast.
Delighted to be with you anytime.